everybody, and welcome back to not just a big week. We always say it's a big week. This is like the biggest week that we've had in some time. Because we got a few things that are going on. We're gonna have the end of the impeachment trial, which was a sad reminder of the state of American politics. But much more importantly, we're starting off the week with the Iowa caucuses. We're gonna be doing live coverage all night. And it's gonna be pretty big, pretty exciting. I have a feeling you're probably quite excited about that too. Tomorrow is the State of the Union, and on Friday, we have the Democratic debate that's gonna run right between New Hampshire and Iowa. So, you know, who are we gonna have coming out as the big winner in Iowa? Is there gonna be momentum moving to New Hampshire? Like, that debate, pretty significant. And that's probably why the DNC has put it on a Friday night, where a few people will actually watch it. But altogether, you have one of those big political weeks. We're gonna be doing live coverage throughout. Just huge. Also, it's my birthday. I'm gonna say that's the third most important thing in the week. Specifically for today though, we've got a little story we're gonna get to in just a little bit. Later on, Michael Brooks, host of the Michael Brooks Show, is gonna be joining us to break down expectations for the caucus. We're gonna talk a little bit about Mike Bloomberg. We've got Rashida Tlaib making big news over the weekend and more. Founding editor of Mediaite, Colby Hall, is gonna be joining us on the Damage Report for the first time. And later on, we're gonna be closing out the show with our sort of unofficial Damage Report sports correspondent, Rick Strom, host of TYT Sports, is gonna be joining us to talk about the Super Bowl and some of the political sort of reverberations to come out of that. But we do have a million things to get to, so why don't we jump right into it? Since we are, you know, like in the closing days of the impeachment trial, and we've got these caucuses coming up later on today, I think that both of those things should be a reminder that what happens in our government is important. The things that we see that are really obvious, the moves that Donald Trump and his Republican backers have made that have been really bad for the country. But perhaps more importantly, the things that don't get a lot of press attention, that have a significant effect on people's lives in a negative direction, but don't generally get talked about very much. And so what Trump does, what a future Democratic president might do in these areas, very important. And so I wanna focus on one example of that. And that is disability rights and social security funding for people with disabilities. Because the Trump administration is making a fairly significant change that is not getting talked about very much. Now, basically, they're going to be effectively cutting about $2.6 billion in funding for people with disabilities, you know, healthcare and all of that, over the course of the next 10 years, a absolutely huge amount of money. And there is some pushback inside of our elected officials. You know, you got 150 lawmakers in the House and Senate signing an open letter calling it harmful and unjustified. But the media in general, like, this is sort of a thing that we see when it comes to disability rights. It's not a thing that generally gets talked about very much. So I wanna delve just a little bit into how this change is gonna impact the lives of millions of Americans and what might happen if Donald Trump is replaced by one of the leading Democrats in this primary. So what would this change that they're making do? It would require millions of beneficiaries to reprove their disability and navigate a complex web of red tape and paperwork every 2 years. Hundreds of thousands of people could lose benefits even though their condition has not changed. And so effectively what they're going to do is there's various classifications for how often you need to reprove disability, have your condition be updated, all of that. Now, something like that does have to happen, obviously. But what they're going to be doing is creating new classification standards where more people will have to do this on a more regular basis. And when you throw people into that Minotaur's maze of red tape and bureaucracy, the chance that some sort of mistake in your paperwork or an inability or not having enough funding to get the help to go through all this paperwork on a recurring basis, more and more people will, having nothing to do with their disability status, be thrown off of their coverage. And that is one of the ways that they're gonna get to that several billion dollars in savings over 10 years. It's a savings only in that these people will not be saved from the medical expenses for the disabilities that they have effectively. Now, as it stands right now, approving eligibility for benefits is an arduous process. It can take months, if not years, hundreds, if not thousands of pages of medical evidence. We have about the strictest eligibility standards in the world already. This is before the change. And over 60% of applications are denied. Tens of thousands of people die each year waiting for benefits. So you could justifiably and understandably label the current status quo an incredibly cruel and damaging way to do this process, but it's only going to get worse with these new changes. So that's the status quo and what Trump wants to do. Well, what about on the Democratic side? So in a tight Democratic primary race, disability rights has emerged as a leading issue. You have Senators Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang and Pete Buttigieg all have released extensive plans having to do with disability rights. You also have just a few days ago, Bernie Sanders has his own plan, which we're gonna delve just a little bit into. The only serious candidate without a detailed disability rights plan is Joe Biden. And he is a guy that has, while not embracing something like Medicare for All, talked about medical issues as a centerpiece of his campaign. You know, the moonshot against cancer, that sort of thing. But there is this significant blind spot, and that is disability rights. Now, many of the candidates, as we just said, do have plans. And you should totally look into them and understand what they wanna do. I'm gonna dive into Sanders, partially because he's got the most recent, the most fleshed out, and I support him as a candidate. But to give an idea of some of the changes that he would make, his plan vows to, quote, incorporate disability issues into every other area of public policy, which is, from my point of view, it is the Green New Dealization of politics, an understanding of the interrelated nature of policies that don't on their face seem connected, but they're going to do this in this other area. He's gonna create a national office of disability coordination to run policy and to ensure that all public resources are compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. He's going to use executive actions as well as legislation, because this is the sort of area where you would imagine how could senators like vote against some sort of plan to better the condition of hundreds of thousands or millions of people with chronic medical disabilities. Mitch McConnell would vote down all of it. And so he will use executive actions to get across some of this. They're going to ensure that every American who needs it can be supported in their own home by workers that are compensated at fair wages. So there, that's sort of the labor philosophy overlaid over new rights for people with disabilities. You're making sure that people on both sides are doing better under the new system. The proposal would also ensure that the needs of people with disabilities as well as older people are met with his proposed Medicare for All plan, as well as eliminating the SSI program's marriage penalty, which reduces the amount that two beneficiaries may receive if they are married. And so that is a great example of what he's saying when he's saying that this sort of overhauling of how the government approaches disability rights is going to be integrated into other policies, including centerpieces to his campaign like Medicare for All. Now, as I said, the other candidates do have plans as well, and all of them look like good improvements, not only on Donald Trump who's moving us in the wrong direction, but the current status quo as well. And I wanted to talk about this, and I wanted to have it first in our show, because these sorts of issues, how fundamental they are to so many Americans, deserve far more attention. And at a time when we are talking about what Donald Trump continuing his term and possibly having a second one means, and when we're debating between these different primary candidates, these are the sorts of issues that should be foremost in our minds. Now with that, we do have a lot of other news that we're gonna get to. Michael Brooks is gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Thank you. Tonight, the Democratic primary becomes real with the first actual contest in Iowa. Things are shaping up to be exciting one way or the other. And joining us to break down this and other big news of the day, host of the Michael Brooks Show, Michael Brooks, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, John, great to be talking with you.
Great to have you here, and on a pretty good day for it too. So look, Iowa's gonna be happening a little bit later on. As of the last polls that I saw, Bernie Sanders has a 7-point lead. This is according to a final poll by Emerson College. Second place, you got Joe Biden at 21. But the polls are really kind of all over the place, generally with Bernie in first. We got a couple different things in here that I wanna talk about. But just going into the day, what are some of your expectations, some of your hopes? What do you wanna see?
Well, I mean, obviously, it looks really good. I definitely want to underline fight like you're 10 points behind as a Bernie Sanders supporter. Mm-hmm. And I also want to be extremely attentive to the games that will be played potentially to undermine his candidacy. I think it's very important, you know, coming out of 2016, I don't want to get caught up in the semantics of it. But, you know, the thumb was on the scale for Clinton so that basically anytime there was a jump ball decision, it would go for Clinton, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I think about it. Now, at the same time, you know, she did win several million more votes than he did, and he did an incredible job coming out of nowhere to win, I believe, over 20 states. This time, we're seeing in real time the profound bias against him. I know we'll get to some of it later, but I always remind people, you know, Barney Frank is on the Rules Committee as just one of many examples. The guy sits on a bank board, is ideologically opposed to Sanders in this movement, but also like personally hates him mm-hmm. in a very weird personalized way. So things could get really dirty. That being said, I think, you know, when Sanders was actually behind in Iowa and people were like, no, there'll be this secret surge and the polls aren't reading it, that's when it gets dangerous because it's like, whoa, that's not how it works. But that being said, he goes in with a lead and he has the only real movement and ground game. I think you got to be feeling really confident if we do what we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can, like, our job is to try to understand this at a deeper level than people who it isn't their, you know, main focus, but also especially people on TV who, where it is their main focus, but they're terrible at their jobs. So we're supposed to be able, we can, what's that?
They're really bad, man.
Yeah. You know what, actually, let's go to an example of that because there's a lot that I want to talk about, but this is a caucus. And for people who might be new to the process, that is different than a primary. It's a little bit more complicated. And so at times like this, we turn to the experts to describe what it's going to be like. So for this, here's a quick little explainer from Chris Saliza.
The word caucus is actually an Algonquian word that means to meet together. Huh? That's interesting, right? Sidebar. Did you know that Milwaukee is also an Algonquian word? It was originally pronounced Milwaukee and means the good land. I learned that from Wayne's World and Alice Cooper. And sidebar. The best way to understand the difference between a primary and a caucus, you ask? A primary is a vote. A caucus is a conversation.
Just a quick reminder, he makes more in 1 year than you and I will make in half a decade probably, but anyway.
So stealing from our Google documents, because we were gonna do that same bit on the next TMBS.
Were you really? Okay, I didn't even know that you could see we were in your Google Docs.
Okay, no, I'm saying he did, Saliza, not you.
There you go.
Yeah, so funny, yeah.
So look, Bernie could win by a bunch, potentially. There was one poll that had everyone else under the threshold to even get delegates. He could win first, but it could be close, or he could end up finishing second or third, depending on what happens. I mean, we have to bear in mind, it is just 41 delegates out of literally thousands that are up for grabs, but there is this concept of momentum, and what happens will be exaggerated in people's minds. What do you think the significance of those different possibilities will be? How will the media attempt to frame them?
Well, I think, you know, as a movement and as really a campaign that can fairly call itself a movement, we got to plow ahead regardless, because from a numbers perspective and a campaign engagement perspective, it doesn't look like there's any scenario where Bernie isn't coming out of Iowa as a top two candidate. I really don't see that. Now, if he doesn't win, we know the media is going to absolutely try to bury him. And I would actually say with the polls looking the way they're looking, even if he doesn't win by more than 2 or 3 points, they're going to try to convince, absolutely bury him. But I think we're getting to a point now where people can really comfortably see that, you know, they know that the bias is so extreme and so exceptional that to some extent you got to just tune into, you know, programs like this and just keep doing the work. But from the perspective of cable news, newspaper headlines, and people kind of, you know, who are already very hostile to Sanders, if it's not convincing, they will paint it as a loss. Now, if he wins, I think you'll get your, you know, several hours of maybe they'll chip him off a couple of hours of positive coverage, and then all of a sudden we'll be back to, you know, the Sandinistas and what, you know, whatever, you know, Chris Matthews had coffee with a dock worker in 1969, and that means that Bernie can't win, and you know, all of this nonsense will come back.
And it's also entirely possible that they could acknowledge, like, if he somehow were to win, such that he gets all the delegates. You could have a couple of days of news coverage focused entirely around how scary is the prospect that this guy might be the actual nominee. Like, think about the attacks they're going to run against him, and then they will in fact do all those.
Yeah, not to interrupt, but I think you're 100% right. I think that will be the coverage. I can't believe we're actually doing this. And you know, the thing that's really important to point out about this, that's incredible, is that I think that I'm willing to acknowledge that there are certain I don't necessarily know high risks. Bernie's actually very well situated against Trump and even Trump specifically. But sure, we'll run a campaign where the socialism word might scare some people who are older voters, where the entire American oligarchy will try to destroy one candidate. Okay, these are going to be some untested propositions. But the incredible thing about this, you know, Chris Matthews world is that they don't have, and I think maybe this is actually what's freaking them out. Maybe they're starting to understand this. They don't have an alternative. You know, the Democratic Party has done such a horrible job of training talent and building infrastructure that, I mean, he denies it, but supposedly John Kerry is saying the other day, like, oh, fine, guys, I'll come in and save it. I mean, are you kidding me?
Wow.
John Kerry will be, I mean, you know, we're at the level through the looking glass here of, well, okay, fine, let's do 2004 again. I'll lead another massive loss. The incredible thing, and I think that leads the freak out, and if you look into the numbers, is that Bernie Sanders is both the obvious challenge to the capitalist class. He's also really pound for pound, not a guaranteed win, but he is the safest nominee. I mean, look at all these other options. They're deteriorating. Some cases, literally. And Mike Bloomberg, I mean, look, he's got money, but are you kidding me? Trump would love to run against him.
I don't know. Did you see that ice cream ad? It was compelling.
Yeah, money well spent.
Exactly. Yeah, at least on the ice cream, if not the ad. Okay, so Michael, stick around. We're going to switch gears and talk about some other news in the cycle after this. Over the weekend, a whole bunch of people worked themselves into a tizzy over Rashida Tlaib daring to boo former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Here's the video.
When someone by the name of Hillary Clinton said that nobody, we're not gonna boo, we're classy here.
No, classy. I'll boo. Boo. You all know I can't be quiet. No, we're gonna boo. That's all right. The haters will shut up on Monday when we win.
There we go.
She might be right, but we're not quite at the win yet, and the haters have not yet shut up. Joining us to talk about the haters, Michael Brooks, welcome back to the show.
They will never shut up.
No. So she booed Hillary Clinton. I get it. It's not polite or whatever. But yeah, the reaction was pretty strong. What do you think about the representative booing Hillary Clinton?
I think she shouldn't have apologized. I think, you know, there's actually something here that's substantive. There's an incredibly dysfunctional, dangerous, and corrosive, policing that is, you know, and I've talked about this in the Exiting the Vampire Castle essay, which is a kind of broader problem on the left that needs to have a much more kind of forgiving and resilient culture generally. But then even more specifically, it's just so unbelievably misused in basically from kind of conservative members of the Democratic Party. I mean, that want a free license to, you know, bully, to lie, to distort, to everything you could imagine. And then when there's even the most kind of minimal pushback, then we reach for the smelling salts. I mean, this is the context of, you know, Hillary Clinton absolutely trashing Bernie Sanders and then just giving a little boo in response. I mean, it's funny because in some ways it's unimportant. And maybe even there was a time where I could see the perspective of don't even get distracted by it. But it actually is a signal, and it's sort of part and parcel with the more formal stuff. Like, we're going to have a rules committee that's stacked against one candidate. Like, we're going to, you know, all of a sudden consider changing debate rules to accommodate one oligarch that funds us. I think there actually does need to be a certain type of pushback. And frankly, it's synchronized with the argument of what a Sanders administration would be, which is that we're not looking for stupid, destructive, and unhealthy fights at all. But if we need to have them, we'll have them, because people need to have healthcare. People need to have homes. People need to live well. And we can't just keep letting this parasitic elite, deprive people of that. And obviously, you know, I mean, there's a lot of disgust this week for me looking at the precision of how relatively incompetent the Democrats are going up against Trump, and how willing they are to just be ruthless to kind of try to put down the energy coming from Bernie Sanders. I don't think she should have apologized, and I'd like to add boo.
Yeah. And look, I largely agree with you there. She did, though. I want to read her statement. She says that she had allowed her feelings about Ms. Clinton's remarks to get the best of me. I think that statement is literally true. It brought out the best in her, actually. But anyway, she tweeted, "However, I know what is at stake if we don't unify over one candidate to beat Trump, and I intend to do everything possible to ensure that Trump does not win in 2020. In this instance, I allowed my disappointment with Secretary Clinton's latest comments about Senator Sanders and his supporters get the best of me. You all, my sisters in service on stage, and our movement deserve better." So look, I think that we are unified in thinking that she didn't need to do all that. Especially, it's not like she brought up Hillary after Hillary's been out of the news for 3 months. Hillary has been going on every podcast she can to attack Bernie Sanders over the past few weeks. But I wanted to read this for you. This is from Nick Merrill, Hillary's spokesperson. "I can't imagine this kind of behavior is something Iowans want to see from candidates and their surrogates. And I don't imagine the vast majority of voters in Representative Tlaib's district, which Secretary Clinton won by over 60 points in 2016, want to see this either." So that a fairly clear threat against Rashida Tlaib in the name of unity.
Well, right. And also, I would want to know, I believe that's a general election number. I'd want to know what primary looked like in her district. The other thing is that most people in Iowa and everywhere else don't care. This is the type of thing that maybe once in a million can get blown up into a cultural moment. But this is mostly stuff for people who obsess about this stuff all day. People have jobs and lives and things that are important, and they don't. And if they want to get mixed up in kind of relatively trivial drama like this, I think they prefer to like read People magazine or follow sports, right? Like, it's, you know, the melodrama is ridiculous. But I do think the substantive point here is, and there's almost no one like this. I can't even think of an example. But if somebody said, "Look, I just want to beat Donald Trump. I'm not ideologically attached. And so I have nothing but positive things to say about Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Mike Bloomberg, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and whoever else has run and is running," I would disagree with that, because I do think we need to deal with Trump and the origins of Trumpism. But I can totally respect that viewpoint. The problem is that people in other camps, including the Warren camp, including, you know, certainly people around the Clintons, use this rhetoric of unity to always subtly or overtly undermine Sanders. So it's totally disingenuous. Yeah. If you're talking about unity, then I don't want to hear you criticizing anybody. I want you to say, "Boy, gee golly, Joe Biden's got experience, and Warren's got those great blog posts, and, you know, Bernie Sanders has the energy," or whatever other, you know, sort of generic positive comments you want to make. But we are drawing distinctions, and there's big distinctions here, and that's what a primary process is. And I really resent the passive aggressive and disingenuous way it's used to target one campaign.
I agree. And everyone, please take a minute, if you haven't already, my latest article for The Hill was the establishment scam of unity. So definitely take a look at that. One other topic for you, Michael. We found out recently that Donald Trump, in a secret recording, had admitted that the one person he didn't want to be chosen in 2016 as Hillary's VP would be Bernie Sanders. So he implied that he is scared of Bernie Sanders, at least to some extent. Last night, during his interview with Sean Hannity, he took the offensive against Bernie Sanders, perhaps because that news was out there. I want you, Michael, to take a look at this video, and you let me know if you think that this sort of attack against Bernie Sanders is going to be successful or not. Here's the video.
Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think he's a communist. I mean, you know, look, I think of communism when I think of Bernie. Now, you could say socialist, but didn't he get married in Moscow? And that's wonderful. Moscow's wonderful.
Might have been the honeymoon.
You don't think necessarily, well, whatever. But you don't necessarily think in terms of marriage, Moscow. And it's wonderful. I'm not knocking it, but I think of Bernie sort of as a socialist, but far beyond a socialist.
Elizabeth Warren.
At least he's true to what he believes. That's one thing.
Okay, so let's be clear. He's not knocking it. He thinks it's good. So anyway, this is what he's got against Bernie Sanders. Should he be as scared as he implied he was in that secret recording?
Yeah, I really do. And I think that even his disses are very revealing. I mean, his material on Bloomberg, Mini Mike, that's bringing me back as an audience member who's followed Trump stand up for a while to some of his classic hits. You know, that's really good material. I'm sorry, Elizabeth Warren, he'll eat right up. You know, there's things that maybe we don't talk about in the Democratic primary, but he'll dine on, like her heritage, frankly. And what she's claimed about it, and whether that's fair or unfair, that will, I think that will resonate. I think Trump will have fun with it. It's very revealing that he always, I've seen other clips where he goes into the crazy Bernie thing and the communism thing, and then he always kind of doubles back with either a reaffirmation that at least you know where you stand with Bernie, or maybe that's even a good idea. The other part that's funny is like, well, I mean, Moscow marriages, you know, I'm burned out on all the Russia stuff. But, you know, the jokes about Trump and what kind of Moscow marriages he might be interested in write themselves. And I think that what is interesting, I've heard from, I believe it was Sagar and Jetty on his show, you know, he co-hosts The Hill with Crystal Ball, really good guy. And, you know, on the right, he said that the people around Trump who are more of the sort of like, you know, insurgent right-wing people are scared of Bernie. And the kind of, you know, traditional Republicans are chomping at the bit to run against him. Mm-hmm. And he's setting everything else aside. I mean, I think we know who has a better sense of the pulse of the country. I just think on a very specific level, the only people that it's going to be a stumbling block for apparently are people like on MSNBC who are freaked out about this. But I think in the broad general population, particularly amongst younger voters, it's mostly utterly irrelevant, frankly. Then there'll be a handful of people who actually might know about some of these historical moments and say, well, of course, Bernie Sanders, good for him for speaking out against the Reagan administration backing death squads that were murdering nuns in Latin America in the 80s. That's good. And then the people who think that, you know, our precious bodily fluids are going to get sold off or whatever, they're already going to vote for Trump anyways. So I don't want to underestimate it. But I really don't. I think people are leaning way into it too much. And I also think the Republicans did us a favor by calling Obama a socialist for 8 years. They have basically made the word mean you're a vaguely decent person.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that you're probably right. And hopefully we'll be lucky enough to find out what that general election would look like. Michael Brooks, as always, thank you for joining us, everybody. Check out his show.
Thank you, John. Great pleasure. Take care.
Enjoy tonight, by the way. We're going to take a short break. We come back. Colby Hall is going to be joining us on the other side. Last night, Sean Hannity had a big interview psyched up around the Super Bowl. It was Donald Trump, who has not done many nationally televised interviews ever, and certainly not without it being Fox News. But they spoke, and it was an interesting experience. And joining us to break down some of what came up in that interview, the founding editor of Mediaite, Colby Hall. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. So Trump finally does an interview. It is with Fox News, and we know that it wasn't like Chris Wallace or, you know, one of the journalist types. It was Sean Hannity. As a strategy to have this super high profile interview be one of their most like just pure opinion people, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think that Donald Trump is holds all the power in that dynamic. He refused to do an interview, I think 2 years ago when NBC had the Super Bowl. And I'm sure that he said, look, I'll do the interview, but I have no interest in being interviewed by Bret Baier or Chris Wallace. Sean's my guy. He and Sean Hannity are very, very close. And, as much as doing a favor of Sean Hannity, and he also knew that it was going to be softballs and it was going to be like super soft. And in fact, much of the interview was, word association, which ended up sort of the president just being sort of the insult comic, just insulting Democratic candidates, which, is entertaining, I guess, but certainly is not presidential or as presidential as we used to think. But again, I would say that this isn't the first time an opinion host has done this. Bill O'Reilly interviewed President Bush a couple times and interviewed Barack Obama a couple times. But you could argue that O'Reilly is different than Hannity and Trump is very different from the presidents that came before him.
Yeah, I mean, Bill O'Reilly was not a news guy, but Sean Hannity is, he reminds me so much of almost Alex Jones, less disaster seeds, but a lot of the commentary is very similar. And also, the personal connection between Sean Hannity and Donald Trump, I think, is significant. That they apparently talk on the phone, he gives him advice, they shared a lawyer. That seems beyond just, let's give you someone who's going to give you softballs. They have a special connection that I don't know that an interview and a president often ever have.
Well, exactly right. And I think the problem here is that people think of that it will in any way be sort of hold up to any journalistic standards. Of course it isn't, and of course it won't. This president, all he cares about is ratings and all he cares about is entertainment. And so he sees this opportunity, got a lot of attention, it got a lot of eyeballs, and he can use it to propagate that which he wants to propagate. And I think there's a few things. Fox Broadcasting is still owned by Rupert Murdoch, and so he has a say in this. But you could argue that ever since Roger Ailes left, there's been some sort of a vacuum of leadership at Fox News that has been filled by Donald Trump. He's the guy that sort of, he's not running Fox News, but there's clearly, the most powerful people at that network are clearly eager to please him. And so was there any sort of anything of real merit or truth that came out of that? No. But sadly, that's the time that we're in right now is, a classic symptom of this sort of, anti-intellectual, anti-journalistic standards that we have under this administration.
We're getting into the thick of the primary now, and I saw a recent bit of your work on Mediaite talking about a poll for Democratic primary voters. Where are they getting their news when they turn to TV? And apparently, CNN just dominated over not just Fox News, which you obviously would expect, but MSNBC as well. What do you make of that?
Well, that was really surprising, and I put some thought into it. And the real answer is I'm not exactly sure. I think CNN had 62% of the respondents, and MSNBC was around 42, and Fox News was like 22 or something like that. I think MSNBC has become a place for a lot of progressive thought, and they do really well, and they usually do better than CNN in overall ratings. But if you look at their sort of target demo, which is sort of advertising against, CNN compares pretty favorably. I suspect, MSNBC made a sort of strategic decision about, 7 or 8 years ago to lean in and sort of be kind of the counterweight to Fox News, which they've since tried to retract from. But their primetime programming is clearly opinion-based and it's smart and it's good. CNN still sort of, even though they're all in on an anti-Trump news reporting, and reasonably so, they still sort of are the last to sort of hold on to classic capital J journalism. And they also are one of the few networks that have, they feature pro-Trump voices. And so you can argue and say that, the panel discussions and these fights and the over-the-top hyperbole isn't necessarily helpful and it's not really journalism. But you do hear a debate, whether it's Scott Jennings or Rick Santorum or Sean Duffy, and they get a lot of criticism for putting on people who are amplifying Trump's lies. I happen to argue that I think it's good to have a dialogue, right? If they're lying and they're saying bad things, they can get called out in real time. So I think lately there's been so much news around impeachment and the politics, and I think that CNN has an edge in sort of the connotation around it of being more of a news outlet. Now, I know there's probably people snickering at that, but I think that's the case.
So I want to ask you. You talked about CNN, MSNBC. They're leaning in, you know, a while back. And I will admit my bias as a person who a progressive host for the Young Turks. I never saw their leaning in as leaning particularly far. But you did mention that it wasn't that much after that that they sort of went back to standing up straight. Right. To what extent can you really differentiate CNN and MSNBC on some sort of like willing ideological bent? How much does that actually exist to the extent that it ever existed?
That's a, give me 2 hours and I can sort of break that down. I mean, that's a big question. I think NBC News has a terrific news organization. Fox News really doesn't have much of a news aggregation news department. They've kind of become aggregators. CNN also has, I would argue, like especially in the political world and inside the Beltway, CNN has like sort of like top-notch news outlet. So I think the difference there is that they both have strong news outlets. I it's a matter of opinion. I think the evening primetime, Chris Cuomo, Don Lemon on CNN. They are very clear critics of President Trump, but they still, and they lead panel discussions and they try to be fair, but they're not sort of kind of nakedly progressive. Whereas you see Chris Hayes, Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, they're going all in. And so I think you find a distinction there. And you could argue that MSNBC is pretty straightforward and you know what you're going to get. Whereas, CNN claims to be some sort of ideologically sort of pure, but yet what they're putting on air is different. And I would argue that, Rachel Maddow, for example, could be, she's clearly an opinion host, but, she showed journalistic chops. She was a tour de force when she interviewed Lev Parnas and made a ton of news. And so, yes, she may be sort of like an opinion host, but she anchored and did that interview with such command of the facts. She showed, and I sent her a note saying, like, well, that was masterclass. The media world needs more Rachel Maddows. We at Mediaite don't cover much MSNBC in that regard because we kind of cover like the crazy, over the top hyperbole and the gaffes and the fights. And MSNBC is often entirely too reasonable, right? Like this is a smart take, and it's also less surprising because you can. You kind of know what they're going to come out with. I think that MSNBC and actually Fox News has what I call a classic rock problem. Like there's only so many times you can hear Stairway to Heaven. And there's only so many times you can hear Sean Hannity talk about Uranium One or Ukraine conspiracy. And CNN, because they have some conflict and they do have competing points of view, it can be, it's scarce. It can be a bit unique.
Yeah, for me with Sean Hannity, it was once actually. That was enough. I was good. Colby Hall, founding editor for Mediaite. We really appreciate you joining us. Hopefully, we can talk soon.
I'm here for you whenever you need. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take one last break here. On the other side, TRT Sports' Rick Strum joins us to talk about the Super Bowl and more after this. Obviously, the Super Bowl is about sports, but sometimes a bit of politics works its way into that, into the event, and especially the halftime show. A bit of that happened last night as well, which Fox and Friends noted. Let's take a look.
Did you watch the halftime show?
It was great.
J-Lo, Shakira, how amazing. They can move.
All right. I had no idea Shakira had such a great body. I heard about it, but to see it almost in person. And you know what?
There's her daughter.
And there she is right there. Well, watch. He flips it to the Puerto Rican side. It was. And the question is, when they see, put those kids in the audience, the daughter is fantastic.
Isn't that cute?
But the daughter, but the controversy is, I don't know
she's
if we're going to put the
music. She's 50 years old.
What controversy? Just that they would hold up
Puerto Rican flags in the middle, in front.
On the field, right. What I didn't know at the time is what it's portrayed for now, unless I see another explanation, is they have kids would look like they're in cages. And a lot of people thought, is this something of going after
things?
The administration?
The circular things that were
kids in cages, and that is what Democrats say about Republicans, about their border policy. Well,
Okay, so let's show you just a little photo. You can see the daughter singing. I believe it's the daughter singing in one of those circular cages. How dare they? Well, joining us to break down exactly how they dare, Rick Strom of TRT Sports. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Jonathan.
Thank you for joining us. When politics and sports mix, we get to talk a little bit. So,
my goodness, we should talk every day.
We should. He was not happy with that.
Kilmeade?
Yeah, I would love that they don't talk before the show. So, like, Ducey was like, "What controversy?" And then she thought it was about the flag. And then she actually, to her credit, went on to say, "Well, that's her culture. She can wear the flag."
Who?
Ainsley Earhart,
got her.
Which is a nicer thing about a non-American flag than I've ever heard said on Fox and Friends.
But fair point to you.
What about the cages?
What about the cages? Mm-hmm. All right, first off, Brian Kilmeade sucks. just like to come out in like what is such a spirited halftime show and to compliment a woman's body. I mean, look, Roger Ailes may be gone, but my God, do they still have the beliefs in that building? Mm-hmm. That guy sucks. If you want to hear a takedown of him, just listen to Jimmy Kimmel's monologue about Brian Kilmeade and the way that Kilmeade would say one thing and, you should absolutely watch it. And thus, we'll watch it after the show. But staying on point, aside from Kilmeade being a terrible human being, the Super Bowl halftime show was full of political statements. Mm-hmm. I liked how they had "Let's Get Loud" when they had the kids in cages, which is basically saying, hey, we should probably still be talking about this because there are so many millions of things that this administration does that just sucks the life out of all of us because it's just one head smack after another, one depressing note or footnote to an entire story every single day that it honestly does get lost in the shuffle. So I understood that. What I absolutely despise, and I don't know if you're going to be talking about this or not in your rundown, but the right-wing Twitter mob going after Shakira.
Oh, yeah. Saying that it's, you know, like Charlie Kirk had said, it was like the libs say they're against human trafficking, and yet look at the strip show and the pole dance. First of all, that's that two women consensually performing the way they want to is not just not sexual trafficking, it's sort of the exact philosophical opposite of it.
Right.
And he also said, what a terrible image to send to the millions of young women around the globe. There's more than a few million.
There's way more than a few million. On top of that,
But they liked the show, but a lot of right wingers were like super inappropriate. How could they show this to families? I mean, these are women and they're dancing.
Right. Just the main thing that I want to get back to is when everyone went after Shakira for doing something that is paying homage to her father, who is of Lebanese descent.
Yes.
It's called the Zagruta. Mm-hmm. And basically, what she was trying to do was honor her father to say, look, I'm performing in the Super Bowl halftime show.
I thought
it was brilliant. Yeah. The dance was from her hometown in Colombia, paying homage to where she is from. So the fact that we have Fox and Friends Monday morning quarterbacking, judging females' bodies, and also dissing not only Puerto Rico, which they still think, I'm sure, isn't even part of America, it's pretty much to a T what they're about.
Well, I would say in this one case, when she had the flag, I was like, oh God, what are they gonna say? What they had to say about that from Ainsley Earhart was perfectly fine. She was like, she likes her culture. And I thought, let's hear more of this.
She likes
Fox.
Her culture. I don't have to, but she likes her culture.
Because I was like, I was ready to be like, dude, you guys love like the Confederate flag and the Texas flag, like which she can't have her flag. But Ainsley was actually good on that issue. I want to give her credit. Mm-hmm. Really fast, Trump did congratulate the great state of Kansas for Kansas City winning. Mm-hmm. That was deleted eventually.
Of course it was.
Because it's stupid.
Of course it was. Did you hear Ducey's argument this morning?
What?
Did you hear about this? Well, technically it's in Kansas. And therefore, let me just say, I wrote this morning. It's a piece coming out later on an extension of this network that I run on TYT Sports. Basically, imagine if Elizabeth Warren tweeted this, or imagine if Kamala Harris tweeted this, or if Amy Klobuchar tweeted this, or anyone.
AOC,
anyone. What would happen? They wouldn't go to
end of the world.
Technically, there's a small little bit of it that remains in Kansas. No, they would absolutely crap on them. They would destroy them on social media.
Yep.
So let's call a spade here. There's a reason why he doesn't want us to see his college grades, his high school grades. Mm-hmm. It's because he's dumb as a bag of rocks. Back to you, Jonathan.
He is a big old bag bursting with rocks. I didn't watch the Super Bowl. I was at Disneyland and I made the right choice. But the halftime performance was amazing. And I'm not gonna, but I wish that like I could keep myself in good fighting shape by the time I was 50. It's probably not gonna happen, but we do appreciate
fighting
joining
shape
us, as always.
What does that mean?
Like good shape. We gotta go, but thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Okay.
We'll see you later on.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.